We're in West Hollywood, California, about to talk to Peter Leiden, who's one of the three co-authors of The Long Boom, A Vision for the Coming Age of Prosperity. Welcome to thebooksite.net.
Great to be here. Great talking to you.
Who discovered The Long Boom?
Who discovered The Long Boom? Well, it originated in a Wired magazine cover story of July 1997. Myself and Peter Schwartz, who's the chairman of Global Business Network, a scenario planning firm, and I at the time was a senior editor at Wired, we basically created this scenario of the future, looking out 20 more years, build off the last 20 years of how we've built off these new technologies, built this new economy around it, and we kind of projected out how it's going to play out over the next 20 years. And it was a hit, big hit, very controversial, caused a lot of kind of other people to pile on into the fray of the discussion, and so we built a book around it, and we spent the last 2 years building the book version, which is out right now.
What was the controversy? What did people find wrong with your analysis or your scenario?
Well, in fact, it's all right, I would say now, 2 years later. We basically made the argument, one, these network computer technologies were hitting the point where they were getting extremely productive and they were starting to really reshape a new kind of economy. It was the second kind of argument was this was, in fact, a new kind of economy, which many people now are kind of its standard fodder now of business magazines. But again, 2-3 years ago, it was a real serious debate. And the third thing is we said, hey, we aren't on the back end of this boom. We aren't about to peter off on this boom. But in fact, we may well be on the front lip of a vast global economic expansion. It could go 10, 20 years, and it could be the long boom, as we kind of coined the term at the time. And in fact, here we are 2 years later, and all the naysayers are starting to revise their own projections of how long this boom can be sustained, how long can we keep this thing going. And we're saying, hold on, because it's going to keep going for a long time now.
The United States is experiencing the longest economic expansion since the founding of the Republic. What's the relationship between that economic expansion and the long boom that you talk about in your book?
Well, it's fundamental. I mean, when we talk about the long boom, it's not really about the stock market. That's simply a symptom. Some people misinterpret what we're talking about. We are talking about that we essentially, right around 1980, a lot of things came together, new technologies like basically personal computers, a restructuring of the kind of Western economies with a kind of Reagan, Thatcher assault on the welfare state, as well as a kind of the beginnings of globalization with the kind of shifting of the communist world with Gorbachev and Deng Xiaoping to kind of create a kind of one truly integrated global economy. These things came together, created the conditions over the 80s and 90s to build what is now this booming American economy. We took advantage of these technologies quickest. And we've actually been now exploiting this kind of globalization quickest, too. And so we are experiencing an embryo, a kind of a new kind of economy that could work at a global scale for the long term, early part of this 21st century. And that is the long boom. The long boom is essentially not just about the stock market. It's about this deep, broad economic expansion, very much like what we went through in World War II, except, I would say, bigger and longer, for that matter.
The three pillars of this seem to be the Internet, free access of capital globally, and the elimination of other impediments to the free flow of ideas, products, services, and also capital throughout the world. Is that what the long boom is about?
The long boom, well, it's you're touching on a bunch of it. I would say there's four different ways to think about it. What's happened since the 80s is we've seen a kind of a fundamentally new technology introduced. Again, what we call, in the broadest sense, networked computer technologies. Chips now are getting wired together. That's key one. Then we've had a kind of a wave of great economic innovation, you could say, is the second kind of thing that's happened to come together. Again, building off the kind of rebuilding off the welfare state, the vast industrial economies of the 20th century into this new entrepreneurial 21st century economy. Third thing is this globalization, which clearly is kind of tying the world for a historically unprecedented first time in the history of the planet. We've basically integrated the entire planet under the same economy in a hyper kind of integrated way. And the fourth thing I would say is actually the spread of democracy kind of won the war of the 20th century, which is the ideological war. And what we're actually having is much more open political systems, which in the long run essentially benefit the long-term economic growth too. So you've got all these trends coming together, and what we're trying to do is pull back on this book and say, hey, we're just starting, we're just laying the groundwork for what is going to be the real fruition of this, the real kind of benefits as we actually make not just a larger global economy, but we're going to actually make a better world on the backs of this spreading prosperity and these new technologies.
You're arguing that prosperity equals a better world, aren't you?
We're saying it's a precondition, basically. We think really what you have to do is grow the global economy at rates we say as high as 5 to 6% sustained for 20 years. Again, historically, wake of World War II, you could go about 4% growth. We're saying you can actually, we're pulling more people into this, and we have the technologies to keep this thing going at more like 5-6% growth rates. When you spread that kind of prosperity, then you actually have the ability to actually do all the other kind of things which really are beneficial for people in the long run. And this is where we're kind of moving now. The next phase now is to move into how we're going to restructure our whole society around these technologies and build off the prosperity that's been spread by this long boom.
What are some of the ways that we can or need to restructure our society around this long boom?
Well, the book is basically, as its subtitle says, a vision for the coming age of prosperity. What we feel is like the technology is not the problem, the economy is not the problem. We've figured out that both of them are kind of have to be refined, but essentially they're solid. We're moving to the next phase now is really the politics of long boom. We say we're moving to a whole new kind of realm where we start to move off this economy and we start to actually have a radical innovation moving now into education and in terms of building a learning society and start to really migrate this economy globally and start to really stitch together what I think in the long term, if people look back from 2050 on what's happening here, we're watching a watershed transition, not just to a global economy, but to a new kind of global society, I think, which over the course of the 21st century will really kind of emerge in a way that's not really clear to us right now.
I wanted to ask him if he had been here, Peter Schwartz, but maybe you can speak on his behalf. He wrote a book 10, 15 years ago called Seven Tomorrows, in which he sketched out various possibilities for American society based on different dimensions of politics and economics and culture and so on. If I'm not mistaken, the society that we've gotten and the society that you're saying we're going to get a lot more of in the long boom was, I think, the first one. I'm not sure exactly what it was called, but it was a sensate, entrepreneurial, high-tech, consumption-based culture. Is that a fair characterization of both what he set out as a scenario in that book a while ago and what you're talking about in the long boom?
Well, you could say, you know, it's a long-term kind of relative of this. I mean, Peter built off of his kind of background, and he was roughing out kind of different scenarios way back then. I think it's clear you got to talk about here is the long boom is explicitly, unabashedly an optimistic, positive vision of where the world should be going in the next 20 years. It's what we should do with this new economy, what we should do with this new technology. We feel is really missing right now is a kind of coherent global vision of what we should do now with this, particularly with the United States being the kind of in a position of global leadership like it really no other country is. And so what we're laying out there is the vision that Al Gore and George Bush should be fighting over to kind of tap into. This is the vision of what to do. Now, so in Peter's terms, in other words, it's not just, yet another kind of scenario, seven scenarios of what could happen. This is explicitly what we're hoping can happen, and it plausibly could happen if we start to actually consciously start moving towards this kind of consummation of making this long boom happen, which is what we're proposing here.
Well, I don't exactly understand. Isn't the long boom happening by itself based on all these forces that you've identified?
Well, I think we talk about the 40 years from 1980 to 2020. Obviously, we're smack in the middle of it, year 2000. We're analyzing essentially what's happened in the last 20 years, but we think we've reached a moment of kind of consciousness now as a culture, basically, and as a global community, you could say. And what we have to start doing is consciously start to make this long boom happen, spread it to parts of the world that haven't been easy to kind of transition into this, including Asia, for that matter. We have to kind of start to connect people in our society that have been marginalized by this. We have to start really consciously building out a vision in the same way that, in fact, we did again in the wake of World War II when the beginning of the 60s. We're kind of, let's say, right around 1960 in that boom where we're kind of have been booming through the 50s like we've been booming through the 90s. And now we're starting to kind of hit the agenda of what are you going to do with this? How are you going to build a great society? How are you going to actually really go to the moon, the kind of ambitious things we had in the 60s? We're saying we're about that point now. We're starting to sketch up what are we going to do with this economy? What are we going to do with this technology? We're laying out a good idea, the first draft idea of what to do with it.
I'm trying to focus, though, on who's supposed to do it and what part your book or your ideas are supposed to play in their doing it.
We actually explicitly talk about the book as a first draft vision for the world, basically the future history of the world. And what we throw out there, we make no bones that, hey, we don't have the last word on this. We have, well, let's just say the first word on this. And so we've in fact built a website, thelongboom.org, thelongboom1word.org, and it's actually trying to build a node in cyberspace where people can come, take the book as a starting point if they want, but actually build, run with these ideas, refine these ideas, bring their own expertises. If you know something about Asia, if you know something about whatever, tie into it, take it and run. This is a meme, as they say in the internet. It's a spreading meme. It's a contagious idea that we can actually have it in our power now to actually create a much better kind of world based on this new technology, based on this new economy. And so what Peter, again, and I, and Joel Hyatt, the other author, are saying is like we're saying, here's a starting point. Let's throw it out there, and let's let the whole kind of global community, for that matter, and certainly people in the United States, start to really engage this idea and start to run with it.
Well, on the one hand, well, what you're talking about sounds like it's sort of a radical break with the past. I detect some pretty strong echoes of traditional American ideas, namely technology is good, America knows best, and a great new world and city on a hill will be built if you just do it the way we are.
I think some caveats on that. I think Americans actually really have an interesting kind of position in this, and it's this turn of the century here. We have a remarkable country, extremely innovative country. We're very entrepreneurial people. We're very adept at technology. We're very facile with it. We really work with it. I think it makes sense that right now the largest economy, the most affluent society, is in fact in a position to do the most innovation, to actually provide a lot of the leadership in making this transition to a new form of capitalism and a real kind of a new kind of society. This is we have it in our power actually to do this. And so what we're saying is, let's don't back off of that. We're not talking about a hegemonic, everyone's got to be in lockstep to what the Americans are doing, but we're saying, hey, we can provide a lot of leadership here, we should do this. And in fact, over time, I think the influence of the Americans will wane as other countries, as the European region, as the Asian region, as China, a lot of these incredibly powerful, diverse, and creative cultures also kind of start to migrate quicker in the direction of this new economy and actually seize on these technologies. It happens that the Americans were the first to jump on it, but that's no reason to back away from the leadership position which we're in right now, and I think let's go for it.
It may be on my mind because I was watching 60 Minutes yesterday, and I did a long interview with the person who wrote Dutch, a book about Ronald Reagan. It was President Reagan who I think was always saying, we have it within our power to begin the world over again. That sounds like what you're saying, isn't it?
Reagan, actually, I must say, at the time, I was actually quite upset with Ronald Reagan coming to power in the United States, and my own politics actually kind of clashed with it. But I would say it really is remarkable. He and Margaret Thatcher actually did a crucial thing. They started to actually dismantle this welfare state, bureaucratic industrial economy that we were really saddled with for the whole 20th century, and they started to lead the way, or at least provide the groundwork for this new entrepreneurial networked economy we have. Now, that's not to, and he was also optimistic, and he actually was thinking big, and he actually did have a real sense of America's kind of potency in the world. I think that actually has its place. What we're saying is actually we're talking about what we talk about in the book is a new American ideology. It's not about left, it's not about right, it's not about conservative, liberal. It's about essentially the optimists. I think the new kind of divide in American politics and global politics is going to be between the optimists and the pessimists. And this book, The Long Boom, is really essentially a vision for the optimists, and it can draw off of both parties, both kind of factions, left, right, liberal, conservative. It's actually a kind of a thing that has a lot of commonalities, and we're hoping, for that matter, that it'll help influence the 2000 election somehow. I mean, we'd love it if, in fact, politicians took this seriously instead of, like, all the squabbling that's going on with the kind of back and forth about cultural issues and sniping back and forth. That's what's basically been the politics the last 5-10 years here.
If politicians did take it seriously, very concisely, what would they do?
Well, they do, basically, they'd think global. They'd actually think of the United States in the kind of capacity that we used to think about it in the wake of World War II, have the kind of vision. They'd be much more magnanimous. They'd have a much more inclusive politics. They'd have a much more sense of inclusion in terms of how to draw people and regions of the world into this new economy. We'd have a kind of much more open philosophies, essentially. We'd actually borrow what works in kind of off of conservative kind of ideas of how to run the economy. We'd borrow what was working off of kind of more liberal kind of notions of a kind of open, diverse, and tolerant society. We'd actually kind of reconstruct a new politics off of essentially what we've got here. And in fact, I would say we're talking to sitting here in California. California, and where we come from is Northern California, is really ground zero, I think, in a birth of a new kind of mentality that's actually getting beyond these old fissures of old politics and actually is going to create a kind of a new political kind of mentality, which is going to influence the politics in this country in the next 5-10 years. And ultimately, because of the position of the United States, is going to have a huge impact on global politics in the next 20.
You're arguing essentially that there's something new here. I'm wondering whether or not what you're talking about is going to be sufficient to overcome the kind of human characteristics, forces, and history that are shown in places like Bosnia, Kosovo, Chechnya, East Timor, and some other place next week.
Well, I think one way to look at that, I mean, again, if you focus on the specifics and the horrific kind of ethnic strife and all the kind of wars and things that we do still see, that's one way. If we take the perspective that we constantly try to do in the book, pull back what are generations, what are people in 2050 going to look back as the essence of what's happening around basically our time here. If you think big picture, essentially what we've essentially evolved away from is we've dissolved the Cold War with basically without even firing a shot in some respects, and we've actually kind of migrated to a point where sure we still have these ethnic squabbles, sure we have kind of regional kind of struggles, but in the grand scheme of things, we are stitching together a global community in a way that we haven't seen literally for the last 500 years. I mean, we haven't really engaged a kind of world where all the major powers essentially are kind of peacefully interacting and integrating more and more economically and ultimately with this technology getting stitched together technologically. And so we're going to see a much more integrated global community, global culture, and a global kind of institutions, I would also say, that's going to mitigate and lower the chances of violence in the long run. And so I think what we're going to see is a lot of this breakout of ethnic strife and stuff is, again, transitional struggles, a lot of kind of, it's in some ways distracting, but I think in the big picture, we are watching a real shifting away from the real struggles and the bloodshed and the world wars that we've really went through in the 20th century.
Let me try to ask you as we close, sort of whether that is fundamental or whether it's just kind of superficial. It seems to me that what you're talking about is global integration through technology, through politics, through economics, through culture. Pat Buchanan on the one hand and the Zapatistas on the other are equally opposed to NAFTA and similar efforts to integrate the economies of the United States and Mexico. If there are groups who are run around saying lock and load or actually do lock and load, such as the Zapatistas, who are going to say, we understand your vision of one world run by corporations out of the United States, and we don't like it, and we're going to fight against it. And if that happens in a lot of places, what happens to your vision?
Well, first of all, I think Buchanan, for example, I think is a marginalized, important but marginalized sector of the American population, which really isn't going to wrest control of the direction of this country out of it. So I think in some ways, you know, these are important things to confront. The Zapatistas also are kind of a symptom of kind of the resistance of places to kind of the scariness of globalization. But I would say, in fact, the world that we're talking about is not a kind of world run by a few kind of a cadre of global corporations rooted in the United States. So we think of it, I think we're also seeing alongside the kind of consolidation of a lot of this corporate world, we're seeing a proliferation of incredible kind of small businesses, small entrepreneurialism, empowered people. The internet itself is actually bringing folks like, you know, all the kind of people who can get a voice. There's concomitant trends that are actually counteracting and running in parallel to that same kind of sense of hegemony that some people fear. And I think what we're going to see is not a kind of a world run by a culture run by Disney, but in fact we're going to see a kind of a riot, a breakout of all kinds of individualistic visions and individualist cultures, which will actually kind of burgeon and actually thrive in this coming world. I really believe that.
Well, I believe that you believe it, and it's a tantalizing vision. But if when we walk out of this hotel onto Sunset Boulevard, we will see a world run by Disney, Warners, and Rupert Murdoch.
And that same crew is actually scared to death about the internet. They're scared to death about the proliferation of kind of the ways we can get media out now. And in fact, that world that was run by CBS, ABC, NBC, as we're seeing, is already being shattered, and it's proliferating more and more and more. And in fact, the idea that in fact a few kind of folks are going to control the future is crazy. The last people to try to control the future were the Soviet Union and the kind of communist kind of political structures, and they absolutely blew apart basically in the face of this incredible diversification, this really out of control economy in this out of control world, which in fact we're now at the beginnings of. The world is essentially out of anybody's control, including the powerful corporations, and although they can influence it and make a heck of a lot of money, the world can't be run by these folks anymore. That was a vision that was plausible in, you know, Orwell's mid-century 1984 kind of vision. That's gone, that's past. We're looking at a much more diverse, much more out of control world, and that's a great thing.
I'd say that the dystopia we need to look at is not Orwell, which failed in the Soviet Union, but Brave New World, written in the 30s, in which the entertainment conglomerates and the biotechnology factories control human culture, politics, there was no politics in Brave New World, and consciousness.
Well, I mean, I think this is a healthy debate. It's one that, in fact, we tell, hey, this is what we need. This is what we need, a great global conversation on this. I would basically hold up the kind of more optimistic vision, the more positive vision, that essentially a lot of these developments are in large part are positive. They're things that can be controlled, that can be influenced by obvious, I mean, people coming together, influencing by individuals. And my kind of view of the future is much less scary. And I know it's a difficult time. And in fact, what kind of vision we think about for the future is going to have a huge influence on what, in fact, reality will actually come about. If people are fearful and really kind of paranoid about the future, we're going to have a much more kind of closed and kind of stifled kind of society. If they're much more confident and optimistic about the future, I think we're going to actually build an incredibly prosperous, open, and diverse society, which is, I think, the kind of society I'd like to live in.
One last point. With all of this growth, expansion, consumption, what's going to happen to the environment?
Well, a big part of the book, and if we had time, we could actually go into that. A big part of the book is how can we grow this global economy at those kind of rates at the same time, lower the actual damage to the environment. And we make a very plausible case that with the waves of new technology coming, biotechnology, alternative energy like hydrogen, fuel cell kind of technology, all kinds of a technology, and also nanotechnology, which is manufacturing one atom at a time, something that we're going to really see as a commercial reality within about 10 years. These new waves of technology are going to allow us to lower the damage to the environment through porting to these new kind of generations of clean technologies, and we're going to see this happen. It'll take, you know, 10, 20, not more than that. It'll take basically the first half of the 21st century. But ultimately, we have it in our power to have an economy in balance with nature over the course of the 21st century. That is our kind of challenge. That's one we can master. We can actually solve this global warming bugaboo. We can actually take on this kind of environmental damage if we move quickly to the new technologies as opposed to hanging on to those old industrial technologies, which really were extremely damaging the environment and still are. In India and China, still 70% of their energy needs are on dirty coal. We can do better. We can actually move much further, much cleaner, much faster than we think. And we lay it out there as the thing to do in the book.
You argue that a population increase from 4 billion to 6 billion shows things are okay. And the population leveling off at 9 is what's in the cards. Are you sure that with all of this, that the curve that shows that when people become middle class they have fewer children is going to continue to work, or whether there are going to be other factors that are going to lead to even higher population growth rates?
Basically, in any historical situation, the more you kind of spread prosperity, the more people you pull in the middle class people inevitably lower the kind of number of children they have. If you look at actually the industrialized nations, the most developed nations of the world right now, almost all of them actually have shrinking populations. They can't even sustain themselves because people have lower than the number of children they need to reproduce the society. Again, obviously, with the United States, we have immigration, which kind of counters that. But Europe, Japan, they're looking at extremely aging populations because they can't produce children fast enough. Now, this is actually totally across the board, always happens with development. If we boom this global economy, if we spread this kind of prosperity, this is going to happen in a global context. We will lower the growth rates of the population without question. In fact, already it's affecting UN projections, all the kind of official projections on population explosion are being lowered year by year. There was a thought that we were going to hit 30 billion people on the planet by 2050. Now we're actually thinking that at the most we'll probably top out at 11, 12, even at the worst case scenarios. And then a lot of people are saying, as we do, that we can hit it as low as 8 or 9 billion.
If everything comes to pass that you'd like to see here, we'll have nanofactories producing SUVs that'll run on hydrogen for everybody in the world. It's still going to be pretty crowded on the freeway, isn't it?
Yeah, it will. But on the other hand, we're going to see, again, this is the thing. If you extrapolate on trends right now, and you often kind of see, oh, hey, if all these people are driving cars, it's all going to choke the roads. But on the other hand, you're seeing other trends where we're decentralizing our communications. We're building kind of the capacity to move full motion video. I mean, we're going to probably see over the course of the next 20 years a real devolution of people into different parts of the world that they don't have to be concentrated in these mega cities. I mean, there's a lot of kind of countervailing trends. The nice thing about human beings is they're incredibly adaptive, incredibly creative, and when faced with kind of situations that seem daunting, they actually root around it and try different things. And I think we should actually have more confidence in the ability of people to deal with these mounting problems rather than kind of a pessimism that, in fact, we're being engulfed by this dark new world.
19 years ago, when I ran for Congress in Silicon Valley, my slogan was "Compute, don't commute," because I was sick of sitting on the Central Expressway. And I now do that. I work for a company in New York, and I do it from the San Fernando Valley. But when I have to go out of my home office and hit the freeways here, they're more crowded than they've ever been in 50 years. Something isn't according to your hopes. I mean, I hope, too, that everyone would sit home, use broadband communication, telecommute, and teleshop, and live in a little village around their terminals, but they don't. They continue to drive and consume and commute. What makes you think that it's going to change?
Well, I think when you put your finger on it, you thought with broadband. Basically, what's happened is we've had a real choke point in telecommunications. We haven't been able to actually open up the broadband enough. And I think what we're going to see in the next 5-10 years is essentially an extreme expansion of the bandwidth or the kind of pipes getting to these homes and these kind of sub-centers. And in fact, through that, essentially, you'll actually have the ability to actually do quite a bit more. The other thing I think is, again, you can take other trends going on, too. The cities have devolved quite a bit. We have this whole phenomenon of edge cities that, if again, in the 70s, we had incredible concentration in core cities, but we've actually devolved cities and sub-centers outside in a kind of a phenomenon that Joel Garreau's book, Edge Cities, actually kind of hits right on the head. And so there's, again, a kind of a, and that's, I think, the beginning of, again, with a long view, maybe 10, 20, 30 more years, we're going to see that kind of devolution actually go further, again, built on the kind of capabilities of this new high bandwidth telecommunications that we're actually seeing.
I think what it essentially comes down to in the end is temperament. Whether you're an optimist or a pessimist, whether you believe that the best in human nature and technology and history can be applied to the betterment of mankind, or whether the worst or the mediocre will prevail, isn't it?
Well, I think I would make the argument that the facts are starting to align with the optimists. I think when we first came out with this article a little over 2 years ago, all the media just piled on it and said, you guys are incredibly optimistic, way overly optimistic. And because we were talking about, hey, this boom isn't about to peter out, this thing's actually just taking off. And here we are 2.5 years later, and all our critics from that time are now kind of taken for granted, this new economy, taken for granted that, hey, this economy might keep going. And it's a shift of perspective. I think the case can be made that, in fact, if you start to really look at it, we are essentially... there's real grounds for letting go of that pessimism that has actually kind of really entrapped us since the 70s, I think. We had a real kind of culture of pessimism that it's been really hard to break out of, but I think the facts are... this is like we are facing an extraordinary moment in history here, and instead of kind of dwelling on a lot of the problems in the future there in times and kind of making us timid to kind of go forward, we're saying let's think bold, let's think big, let's lay it out there, and let's move to make this thing, to leverage these technologies, leverage this economy, and make a better world. I mean, let's just unabashedly get it out there, and we don't have the last word on it, we have the first word, or maybe not the first word, but a word, and let's build on it and make it work.
In the 20s, Henry Luce, fresh out of Yale, founded Time Magazine and coined the term the new American century, and said that more or less what you just said. And shortly after that, there was the stock market crash, the Depression, and World War II. Are you the Henry Luce of the 90s?
No, I wouldn't say the Henry Luce of the 90s, but I do think actually, I think the American century, it's an interesting concept. I think we're actually moving into kind of a global century, but I do think the American presence and the American influence is going to be crucial, and I think we're at a position now where the American people should really start thinking with real largesse and magnanimity, and we should actually be thinking big and generously. We should think of ourselves as global leaders in a way that we can afford to actually help other regions out. And I think in that respect, I like the idea of the call to arms that World War II generation that basically built essentially the mass consumer society in the wake of World War II, they actually did an incredible job. They built an infrastructure that actually let these children of the prosperity of the boomers actually really thrive. I think where the boomers now are who are actually kind of running things now have this historical obligation to take advantage of this opportunity here, build the planet, build essentially an infrastructure for a kind of a better 21st century world that we can hand over our children. We have the power to do it, and we have, in fact, we're starting to get conscious of our historical opportunity here, and I'm just saying we actually need to get at it, get to it, and this book is a shot to try to get people thinking that way.
Maybe we could call it the California century. Thank you very much, Peter Lydon, for talking to us about the long boom.
Great to be here, and great to keep at it. By the way, there also is this website that you can actually pick up on these ideas and run with them yourself. So
tell us the website.
It's thelongboomoneword.org, and builds off the book and lets other people take their own ideas and chime in.
People ought to be able to click to it right below this interview here. Thanks very much.
Great.